It is 7:16, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Big day for the city, big day for Helena Moreno, all the council members that are going to be sworn in here at WWL, because we'll have coverage of that starting at 8:30. Actually, I'll be joined by Dave Cohen and Newell Norman at 8 o'clock to talk about it. And it's a big day for the people that live and work in the city and that depend on the city of New Orleans. Ed Chervenak joins us now, professor of political science at UNO, my alma mater, I'm proud to say. How you doing, Ed?
I'm fine, Tommy. How are you today?
I'm okay, sir. Is it am I gilding the lily too much, or is it really a big, important day for the city today?
No, it is an important day that we're witnessing the peaceful transfer of power from one elected official to another, the hallmark of democracy, and that people are looking at this as a reset and going into this with a general feeling of optimism.
How do you even begin this, Ed? Because, Helena Moreno was saying it hit her yesterday, I think, at the cathedral when part of the inauguration ceremonies that Ms. Benson is spearheading included a mass at St. Louis Cathedral. She was walking down the aisle with her husband, and she said it really sunk in that, I'm going to be the mayor here. How do you even begin to, and I'm sure she realized it before, I'm not saying, you understand what I mean, I don't want to give
the moment of clarity when it's like, oh my goodness, this is really happening.
Yeah, and I think we all go through it, it's just human nature. So how do you start, Ed? Where does she go about it? Because she's already, in a way, started, I guess, right?
Well, she's been the de facto mayor, basically since she was elected. She's the one that led the effort to get the $125 million revenue bond so that the city could meet payroll till, for 2025. So she's basically been exercising some authority already. Today, mm-hmm. When she takes the oath, she'll have all the power, privileges, rights, and responsibilities of being the mayor of New Orleans.
One thing I notice almost in my way of looking at this, I hate to say this as an aside, is that she's a Democrat, because I don't care if she's a Democrat or a Republican. That's not the point. The point is she seems to work equally well with both Democrats and Republicans, at least so far in Baton Rouge.
Yes, that's basically from her experience as a state legislator, 8 years representing this district here in New Orleans. And she did work across the aisle with Republicans in passing legislation for protection of domestic people who suffer from domestic violence and sexual sexual exploitation. So she has experience with that. She seems to have a fairly good working relationship with the governor. And so we'll see how that plays out, because we know the governor is not afraid to intervene and interfere in New Orleans politics.
How important will that relationship with the governor prove to be?
I mean, it's going to be important. The relationship with the governor and also the relationship with the state legislature, because, Baton Rouge writes the rules that can regulate New Orleans, they can write preemptive laws and things of that nature. And so obviously Baton Rouge has lots of influence over New Orleans. And so she needs to manage that. And she also needs to manage the relationship with the federal government, particularly with, ICE coming in rounding up undocumented individuals.
Let me take a break. We're going to pick it up when we come back. We joke about New Orleans being a city filled with potholes. I want to talk about where the potholes may be for Mayor-elect Moreno politically for her first 4 years. And also we'll talk about the time frame of how important is the first year, how important are the first 90 days, et cetera, and how aggressive can she or should she be. 7:20, we're talking to Ed Chervenak, our friend, professor of political science at my alma mater, UNO. We'll continue the conversation when we return. Our coverage of the inauguration begins really at 8 o'clock with a little pregame, and then at 8:30, we get it going for real with Newell Norman and Dave Cohen. Traffic now, WWL. 7:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Ed Chervenak, professor of political science at UNO, about the impending inauguration today of Mayor Helena Moreno, mayor-elect, soon to be mayor, Helena Moreno, and the city council as well. she seems to have a tremendous working relationship with the council. She has a really good relationship with from her days in Baton Rouge as a representative. I see a story here at, I think it's Politico, that says she and Steve Scalise talk regularly. Where are the potholes, if you will, that she needs to avoid stepping in, Ed?
Well, when you mention potholes, when she becomes mayor, she will own every pothole in the city. So, you know, people will be looking for improvements in that infrastructure area. But the biggest pothole is the budget. You know, that dealing with this budget deficit, she inherited a, you know, $222 million deficit from the previous administration. And so that means furloughs, layoffs, spending cuts, eliminating programs. Those aren't popular decisions. And so she's going to have to make those decisions. But, you know, she can point to the fact that these aren't normal circumstances.
Politically, I would think that outgoing Mayor Cantrell is not, you know, very popular. And I would think, considering the mandate with which Helena Moreno was elected, that she might have a longer honeymoon than usual, and that people might be more willing to be gracious when it comes to, look, I didn't cause all these problems, I'm just trying to fix it.
Right. You know, most mayors tend to have about a 3 to 6 month honeymoon. Mm-hmm. You know, they take office, then the public, the media, even their political opponents tend to give them some extra goodwill. And this is also the point in time where the mayor has the most political capital, you know, that, you know, she wants to frame the agenda. And so she'll probably have an extended grace period where, you know, while voters see whether she can deliver on her promises. But, you know, right now she's got political capital. She needs to use it wisely.
What's the biggest mistake she could make?
Not being there. She's basically made the promise that she will be a 24/7 mayor who gives 100% to the job, that she's going to bring energy and urgency to the position. And if she turns out that she's not there, that's the biggest mistake she can make.
And conversely, she has to communicate, I'm guessing, right? And be transparent and as open as possible.
Yes. And that seems to be one of her strengths, is her communication skills and her emphasis on transparency.
Any final thoughts, Ed?
It's a new day in New Orleans. I think a lot of people are excited about the new mayor, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Let's hope for the best. I am. Thank you, sir. Ed Chervenak, professor of political science at, I'm proud to say, my alma mater, UNO, soon to be, I think, LSUNO. Coming up, we'll have Bank On It, financial insights you can count on, with Jason Shield, CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Today, we're going to talk about the president made some comments, a couple of social media posts about housing affordability. So we'll talk about the context of that when we return here on WWL. Hey, 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Monday morning, time for Count On It, Bank On It, I beg your pardon, financial insights you can count on with Jason Shields, the CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, Chief Operating Officer for Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Hey, Jason, how you doing?
Doing good, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I'm all excited because we got inauguration coverage coming up, and it's a change from my routine, so that's why I butchered a couple of things. But to show you how smart I am, okay? I'm going to shut up and let you talk, because we're going to talk about, tell everybody what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. So last week was an interesting one for the financial space. There were several social media posts from the administration talking about injecting some money, having Fannie and Freddie go out and buy a bunch of $200 billion in agency mortgage-backed securities in the market, and then also some statements about limiting institutional purchases of single-family homes. Mm-hmm. The idea behind all of that was simply housing affordability. I mean, you and I have talked about this numerous times. And so this is kind of the administration's attempt to really inject something into that market and make some changes. So, you know, as those things came out last week, my phone lit up with folks asking questions like, what does this mean? What's it going to do to mortgage rates? So I thought it would be a really good morning to just kind of talk about what exactly is going on. What do we know? What don't we know? And what's the impact of these things going to be? Right.
All right.
And so so I'll start with the first one, which was you know, President Trump made a social media post, said, I'm directing Fannie and Freddie to purchase about $200 billion in mortgage-backed securities. Okay, that's cool. What does that mean? And then the other one is the one about institutional limiting the institutional purchase of single-family homes. So first, I'll talk a little bit about Fannie and Freddie, because I know everyone knows the name, but they don't really know what they are. And so they're what's called a GSE, which is a government-sponsored enterprise, right? And that's just a cute way of saying in 2008, when the mortgage crisis came, Fannie and Freddie were privately held, right? Like they were a public company, and they held $3-4 trillion in mortgages. And when everything happened in 2008, they had to get sponsored by the government. They went into what we call conservatorship. So now they're a quasi-government entity. They actually are, the government has primary ownership in them, but there is technically still stock associated with it. But what happened there was the government was a backstop for them. And in essence, they became a government-sponsored entity. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you get a mortgage or something like that, they're guaranteeing the mortgage. Their purpose in life is to purchase mortgages off the open market and put them into mortgage-backed securities. Now, once they got acquired by the government, they kind of limited what their exposure could be, right? They had trillions of dollars in 2008. So now they have a much, much lower number. And so the federal agencies kind of limit what they can do. So this $200 billion that they're going to say gets injected is in essence saying we're going to enable them to go buy more mortgages on the open market. And so the theory from the administration there is if you have more demand in the market, that'll drive down those mortgage interest rates. And we actually saw that Friday where we crossed underneath 5% for the first time since about 2020 on mortgage rates, which was really good. And that wasn't even from the purchases. That was just from the promise of those purchases. Now, I like to make an important distinction here. That $200 billion number sounds really huge, but it really actually only represents about 2% of the overall market out there for mortgage-backed securities. And so what we don't know is how are they going to deploy this money? Are they just going to go out and drop that $200 billion at once? Are they going to slowly bleed it in? Because those are the things that matter, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I like to tell everyone in the market for a mortgage right now is just keep an eye on it. Right. Because as the details come out and as we find how they're going to deploy this $200 billion, it's going to impact mortgage rates. Now, a lot of people, you know, we've all kind of speculated over the weekend, economists and others, we've all looked at it. And we think this could have basically about a 10 to 25 basis point impact on that spread of mortgage rates. So that, in general, if you're
what,
seeing
what kind of spread, Jason?
10 to 25 basis points. Okay. I mean, so that's 0.10 to 0.25, right? Basis points is what we call the numbers after the decimal. And so you kind of saw that Friday, right? And that was before anything had actually happened. So it's an interesting time. I would keep an eye on it. And just if you're now, again, I always caution everyone, don't expect rates to go down into the fours, right? You're not going to see that level, not with a $200 billion investment, but you could see some dips. And this could be, if you were on the fence, a really good time to get into it. Now, it's interesting to look at, though, right? Because that's just one of those levers that we can use to control home prices. Because you and I both know if you lower interest rates on mortgages, home prices go up because obviously demand goes up,
right?
And so your ultimate driver is supply. And so if there's not enough houses being produced, and that's just not a spigot that we could turn on, takes a while to build houses, then that's going to drive prices up. So while this will help affordability in the short term, in the long term, you're going to have to get a couple of the other pieces of this pie moving along. And so that's where the institutional conversation came in, right? Which was basically a comment that said, we're going to limit big institutional investors, hedge funds and things of that nature from buying large quantities of 1-4 family homes. Mm-hmm. Because we feel that that's constraining the supply. And so, in theory, this works really great, Tom, because you fix the rate by injecting capital into that market. You fix the supply by limiting institutional investors. And so everything should go really well, and you shouldn't have house prices raising as much as they would if just one of those things changed. Mm-hmm. The problem you have is those institutional investors only represent an actual fraction of the market, not a huge percentage. And in general, where those places buy houses, they're not really necessarily doing it in a place like New Orleans. They do it in large growing areas where housing supply is somewhat constrained. And what they actually do with those houses is they put them out to rent, right? Because there's a huge population that for a variety of reasons don't want to pursue home ownership, either affordability or perhaps they're just temporarily in a location or whatever that is. And so the institutional lender, if you start limiting that type of investment, you could have the adverse effect of actually driving rental rates up, which is good if you're, you know, if you're a renter, but if you own properties that you want to rent. But if you're already having trouble making your rent now and you constrain that supply a little bit more, things can get a little tough. So these are all really interesting things. I want to kind of preface it with to everyone that these were statements, and we don't know the exact implications of how these are going to be implemented yet, but it got a lot of press over the weekend, so I wanted to kind of touch on those. So, you know, go ahead, Tom.
So I'm just wondering, at what point does this become real to people? Like when with the institutional buyers and the private equity companies, for example, at what point does it actually maybe make housing stock more available for them when it comes to buying? Or is that strictly about buying? Or does it lower rents? Or does somebody else move in and take it over? Because it seemed like a couple of different things could happen.
Yeah, no, it could. It could. So I'll tell you, you know, the wheels of progress tend to move slow, Tommy. Social media moves fast. And actual implementation of policy tends to be a little bit slower than those. So nothing's going to change overnight. But, you know, if you're in the market for a home and you've just kind of been sitting on the fence, keep an eye on those 30-year rates every day, right? When you see that number you feel is really good, go ahead and lock it in, right? Anything with a 5 handle right now is a really good rate. Mm-hmm. If you're a renter and you're concerned that your prices of rent are going to go up, you know, touch on the New Orleans area, they unfortunately will, Tommy, right? You and I both know our insurance continues to go up. Our property taxes continue to go up. And if you own the property that you're renting to people, you have to recuperate that money. And that's just unfortunately reflected in the cost of rent. Now, if you long-term get institutional investors out of that, you'll see supply grow and you'll see those rental rates go down. But it's a multi-tiered fix you got to go through. So
and if you,
I would end with just be cautious, everyone, and keep an eye on everything that's out there. Then you should start seeing some progress over the next couple of months in this space.
And you'll never find the perfect moment, right?
Now, if you try to catch a falling knife, Tommy, then nobody wins, right? Like, I mean, you know, you can't time it perfect. Just time it good enough, and I think you're fine.
What a great way to end it. If you try to catch a falling knife, nobody wins. Thank you, Jason Shields, Chief Operating Officer for Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. If you missed any of it, you can download the Odyssey app, use the rewind feature, and go through it a little bit more slowly, if that will help you. 7:55, but some great information. 5 till 8, traffic now, WWL.